From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Jen Lin Lu picked up her life as a newlywed in Beijing to embark on a culinary adventure. For more than 6 months over land, she traveled from Beijing through the Central Asian countries to Iran, Turkey, and then finally to Italy, finding noodles and dumplings around every bend. She looked for the origin of the noodle, where it came from and how it's evolved. Along the way, she met plenty of women who let her into their kitchens and their lives. This hour on Point, Noodle Mania, tracing the origins of the noodle from China to Italy. You can join us on air or online. What's your favorite noodle dish? What is it about noodles that just makes them comfort food? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now in the studio is Jen Lin Lu, author of the new book On the Noodle Road, From Beijing to Rome with Pasta, with Love and Pasta. For an excerpt, go to our website, onpointradio.org. Jen is the founder of Black Sesame Kitchen, a cooking school in Beijing. She's also the author of Serve the People, a stir-fried journey through China. Jen Lin Lu, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me today.
So tell us what led you to take a trip down Noodle Road.
Well, the impetus really began with a trip that my husband and I took not long after we had gotten married. We went to Italy, and my husband treated me to a pasta class in Rome. And in that pasta class, I discovered that the method for making Italian fettuccine was exactly the same as Chinese noodles. Now, I had been a food writer in China for a number of years at this point. So I, had a background in Asian cooking, but have always loved European and Italian food. And on that trip, I just saw so many similarities between Chinese and Italian food. Beyond that fettuccine, there were so many other similar pasta shapes that I had seen across China that I could relate to in Italy. Venice had a history of sweet and sour dishes that reminded me of Chinese food. In the arrabbiata sauce that I tried at one restaurant, that reminded me of a pasta sauce, a noodle sauce in China with hot chilies and sugar.
So was it the base ingredients that were similar or the same, or was it how they were prepared?
I want to be specific that I'm thinking about northern Chinese food here when I'm doing the comparison, because there's many regional cuisines in China, but the northern food and the food I was more familiar with, having lived in Beijing for so many years, has a lot of similarities. Things like the use of eggplant and fennel, you don't really think of those as Chinese. They have a history there that seemed quite connected to European food. Mm.
So we'll get into the details of a lot of this throughout the hour, but set the table for us, so to speak. This trip from China to Italy overland was no small undertaking. How did you prepare for it? 6 months.
Yeah, well, actually, I did a lot of preparation here in the Boston area. My husband and I happened to be living in Cambridge that year, so I did a lot of research at the Schlesinger Library at Radcliffe, and came across a lot of food books, cookbooks that traced some of the history and helped me get ready for my journey. So that was part of the preparation. And then just, talking to as many people from the countries that I would be traveling through, from China to Central Asia to Iran, Turkey, and eventually Italy.
So what are some of the earliest references to noodles that you found in history?
So people always want to ask me, so where did noodles come from? And it really depends on how you define a noodle, actually. Americans think of noodles, and I thought of noodles before this book, as long, stringy, stringy things that are either floating in soup or, topped with a sauce. And it turns out that for Italians and Chinese, the definition is much more encompassing. They're not defined so much by their shape, but what they're made of. Hmm. And the defining substance here is really wheat. And, so it's wheat and generally water or eggs that are made together. And they're the same proportion wherever you go across the Silk Road. And, you know, it's not about the shape. They, as we'll taste today, they can come in the form of raviolis or dumplings or tortellinis. And those are, you know, they can be in little ear-shaped pieces. So the earliest definite sort of mention of noodles that I found was in a 3rd century A.D., Chinese dictionary that described noodles as something called soup bread, actually. Mm. So this was super interesting to me because the noodles actually came from the Chinese tradition of bread. Mm. Bread is not something we readily think of as Chinese, but it actually is a huge part of Northern Chinese food. And one day a chef basically took a loaf of a mound of dough that was going to be baked into bread or grilled into bread and then started ripping pieces into a wok of boiling water. And that's where noodles came from in China.
Mm. Mm. And so how did the Chinese noodle then evolve from 3rd century AD, I think you said?
Yeah, it went westward, I think, through Central Asia. You see many various versions of noodles through Central Asia that are very similar to Chinese noodles, both physically and linguistically. But then there's also, I found a mention in a 5th century AD Jerusalem Talmud from the Middle East, a description of noodles where they are actually long and stringy, like vermicelli. And the tradition of those Middle Eastern noodles probably, most likely, according to many food historians, probably spread through the Middle East, North Africa, Europe. And so it was really two parallel traditions that developed over, you know, many centuries that have brought us, you know, the pasta and noodles that we know today.
Some of the countries that you traveled on your journey were not the safest, Iran most notably, but many of those Central Asian countries weren't terribly safe either. And I'm curious if you were worried ever for your safety. Did you leave any, you know, noodle-rich countries off the trip because you were worried about your safety?
Well, just a couple months before we set out on this journey, Kyrgyzstan had a revolution, and so that was one concern. But by the time we got there, it was pretty safe, and we flew over one small section. I wanted to do it all over land, but basically we did fly from Kyrgyzstan to Uzbekistan to avoid one area that had a lot of riots. And actually, I mean, aside from the fact that we were tailed by a government minder the whole time we were in Iran, actually it was, you know, one of the safest places. We were on the Silk Road. We were very open about the fact that we were Americans in Iran, and people loved us even more after we said we were American.
You discovered quite early on, and you say in the book, that Marco Polo did not bring noodles from China to Italy. Where did that story come from?
So that story actually came from a 1929 publication, an American publication, a pasta trade journal called the Macaroni Journal. And in that journal, there was a piece written by an anonymous writer who talks about how Marco Polo shows up in a place that sounds more South Pacific than Chinese and comes across natives drying long strands of dough. Well, in reality, Chinese don't dry their noodles before they cook them.
Mm. So another story, which actually may be true from the book, is about Genghis Khan and dumplings, right? Tell us that story.
Yeah, well, the theory here is that, and one of the biggest strains of commonalities that I saw among the pasta products was dumplings. You see them, of course, across China. And then in Central Asia, they're called manta. And then they evolve into something called manti by the time you get to Turkey. They get smaller, and then they show up as tortellini. And there's different, many different folding methods, but many of them are similar. They're filled with some kind of, you know, meat or vegetable. And so some food historians have theorized that because this was a very portable food that could be improvised when you're on the road, and we know they're portable today, actually, because I brought them from my home here to the studio. And, you know, this was a nomadic food that could travel long distances and spread. And you see this noodle product, this dumpling from East Asia, from Japan, Korea, and China, all the way to Central Europe, where they're called pierogi.
Mm. Mm.
And that was sort of the whole span of the Mongol Empire.
Mm. What did you learn about hospitality on your journey?
The hospitality was absolutely incredible. I mean, the amount of reception, positive reception we got all along the way, the fact that we were invited to strangers' homes everywhere we went was really a surprise to us. We traveled through a lot of Muslim areas, and we weren't really sure what the reception would be. But as it turned out, many Muslims believe that guests are sent from God and that they have to treat them better than their own family. Mm. So we had a lot of amazing meals and homes.
And I understand we're going to taste a couple of those meals.
Yes.
Upcoming. We're talking about the history of the noodle from Beijing to Rome with Jen Lin Nu this hour. Behind us is some traditional folk music from Shanxi, China. Jen Lin Lu's first stop on her noodle road trip. It's called Song of Blue Sky, performed by the Shanxi Chang'an Female Music Troupe. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the history of noodles from China to Italy. We're joined this hour by Jen Lin Lu, author of On the Noodle Road from Beijing to Rome with Love and Pasta. For an excerpt, go to our website, onpointradio.org. But for some actual noodles, you got to come to the studio. Boy, right. My mouth started watering about 10 seconds ago.
Well, we've got some manta here. Actually, the other one right there. Yep.
So what is manta?
So manta is a steamed dumpling that straddles both China and Central Asia. This one here is filled with little diced bits of pumpkin.
Right? Yeah, I'm going to taste it now.
And cumin, black pepper, a little bit of sugar, and wrapped in a very thin dough. And it's often served with either yogurt or clotted cream.
Mm.
And it's, you know, sort of an intersection of Chinese food, because you have the dumpling, the basic shape there, but then you've got, you know, a little bit of cumin. And
yeah, there's just a little spice as you mm-hmm. get into it. It's mm-hmm. delicious. Just delicious. That pumpkin is such a nice flavor.
Yeah.
And then what's this?
Oh, that is manti. So that was a dumpling that I found further along the road. And it's commonly found in Turkey. And it's basically a tortellini-shaped dumpling filled with meat and onions and bathed in a butter, paprika, walnut sauce, and then topped with another sauce that's kind of similar to tzatziki, Greek tzatziki sauce. Mm. It's a mint and yogurt and garlic sauce there. So that's a really interesting dish, because it's Italian, and it's got this Greek influence, and, you know, so what do you think?
Oh, that one just melts in your mouth, the manti. Mm-hmm. It just melts in your mouth
mm-hmm.
between the meat in the interior. And
there's an interesting story about the manti, actually. The way these are normally folded is that a group of women in a village will basically sit around all day long and fold these, you know, one by one. And if you do them really well, they should actually be the size of your pinky nail.
Hmm.
As you can tell, I'm not a very good...
a bit bigger, but more to enjoy.
I'm not a very good Turkish bride, clearly. And so, basically, if you were able to fit 40 of these on a spoon, you're considered a good Turkish bride.
Hmm.
And I heard that same story, actually, in Italy, many, you know, hundreds of miles away, about tortellini, that basically a good woman... A woman would be judged on how many tortellini she could fit on a spoon.
Mm. Tell us about some more about the women that you met on your journey. Some had extraordinary stories, were so interesting, and others were, well, it's heartbreaking to read, actually, some of what you include.
They really ran the gamut. And, you know, as a traveler, it's hard for me to make humongous generalizations about these places, because I was just a traveler going through these places. But really, in Central Asia, they tended to be quite traditional. And even in the most progressive country there, Kyrgyzstan, I mean, I did meet a very strong career-oriented woman named Gulzat, who actually had studied at Harvard several years ago. And she was a sociologist funded by the George Soros Foundation. But in her home, she lived with her husband and their mother-in-law and their children. And she was basically sort of under the tyranny of this mother-in-law, who basically had her cook all the meals and wasn't allowed to invite friends over. She'd have to cook for her mother-in-law's friends when they came over to show that she was an obedient daughter-in-law. She told me about the tradition of bride kidnapping in Kyrgyzstan, this tradition where a suitor will go to a woman the day of a supposed wedding and basically whisk her off to a wedding that she's not even aware of. The suitor could be somebody she knows. It could be a total stranger. It just really depends.
And she's telling you these stories as you're cooking in the kitchen?
Yeah. I mean, one of the great things about cooking and one of the reasons why I've always focused on food writing myself is not necessarily because of the food. Of course, that's a huge bonus. But it really gets people to open up and gets me into their homes and lets people, you know, not only share their recipes, but their stories and their families with me. And so I found it a great way of getting to know these women.
We mentioned your trip through Iran, how you were sort of constantly watched by government minders, but otherwise had a pretty exhilarating trip. What were the women and the chefs like there?
Yeah, Iran was really eye-opening. I mean, what was great about the government minder actually was that he was a man, so he wasn't able to go into this women's only cooking school that I found. And in this women's only cooking school in a private home, you know, the headscarves came off and women were, you know, in very skimpy clothing sometimes. They were watching MTV on, you know, a large screen television. And, you know, they were very career focused, opinionated, and, you know, very different than what I thought Iranian women would be like. And also very, very interested and positive about the West and about America in general.
Let's take a call here from Alex in Canton, Ohio. Hi, Alex. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. Well, basically, you guys asked about what the most interesting pasta dish that I'd ever had. And in the early days of my marriage, we were so broke. I made more variations on ramen noodles than you can possibly imagine, just trying to add some nutritional value to it, you know? And a lot of us folks on the lower end of the economic spectrum, you know, a lot of people have to depend on that kind of food. And so making an Italian variation ramen noodles with Italian seasoning and beans and a can of diced tomatoes, or making a Mexican one with fajita seasoning and, you know.
Well, that's really interesting. Instant noodles in China. China is the largest consumer of instant noodles in the world. And, you know, I saw instant noodles, of course, on my journey. I'm not a huge fan of them myself. But one interesting incident in my book is when I travel with one of my chefs from my cooking school to his hometown, he actually spreads instant noodles over his father's grave as a way of showing appreciation for his father.
Alex, yeah. Thanks for the call. When Alex talked about making noodles, you know, sort of on a shoestring budget, and specifically early in her marriage, it made me think of your journey early in your marriage, actually, as a newlywed.
Yes, on
the road, on the Silk Road.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting because when I started telling people I had this idea, my friends, they said, that's great, but, you know, what does your husband think about this and what is he going to do? And really, those questions hadn't really come to me at that point because we had just gotten married and we were both foreign journalists and we had traveled all the time before, so it didn't seem to be any different now that we were married, but yet it was because, you know, this was a 6-month journey. I was a little resentful to get those questions because how often does Paul Theroux or, you know, Bill Bryson write about, you know, consider their wives when they're taking these far-flung trips? And but, you know, nevertheless, it did have to fit into the journey. And, you know, Craig, who has been on this show and is a well-known writer, he came along for parts, and, you know, he left me on my own, and he came for parts. And both were fascinating because I could see what it was like to be with a man in many of these places, traditional societies, and what it was like to be without one.
Hmm. Here's Mike in Marshfield, Vermont. Hi, Mike. Welcome to On Point.
Hi there. I have what's probably a pretty stupid question, and you have the option of just guffawing and
hanging up. There's no dumb question. It's okay. Go right ahead.
But it's something that I've been thinking or wondering about for like 50 years. There's all these shapes, like, you know, bow ties and spirals and mostaccioli and all these different shapes of pasta. And if you put the same sauce on all those shapes, they taste different. What is it about the shape?
That is not a stupid question at all.
Jen's shaking her head. She's saying, yes, that's okay.
You do pair different shapes with different different sauces. For example, in Italy, they do not believe that spaghetti bolognese exists. You do not put spaghetti, a very thin noodle, with bolognese because the sauce will just slip off of it. You need to use a tagliatelle, something a little thicker. And so the idea of spaghetti bolognese actually repulses them.
Hmm. 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 Interesting. Stephen is on the line from Illinois. Stephen, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I'd like to tell you about when my children were small, my wife would make an egg noodle. She'd make it fresh. And then she'd have two different kinds of broth that she usually fixed to have for it. It was either beef broth or it was rabbit broth. And the children
sounds
just
delicious.
Craved that stuff.
I bet they did.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I want to emphasize in all this is that, I mean, we make so much pie in America. We make so much, you know, a lot of people are into pizza, but yet pasta is something that we always, almost always buy dried and boil. It only takes a couple more steps. If you know how to make pie, you can make pasta, and it's something that I'd like to see change here.
Right. And so why do you think fresh noodles haven't caught on as part of the American cooking culture?
I think because dried pasta has taken over the market so well. You know, fresh pasta does take a little bit of time. It seems intimidating, but really it isn't. And, you know, for example, the dough I made for these dumplings today took about 5 minutes to knead. And you let it sit for half an hour, and then you can roll them out.
Stephen and Mike, thanks for the calls. Here's Michael in Washington, Illinois. Hi, Michael. You're on. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. Basically, my story is that I did a study abroad in Peru for several months, and Peru has a really interesting history of Chinese-American or Chinese-Peruvian dishes, where it's kind of a mixture of their food in the south with Chinese noodles.
Okay.
And my host family tried to make me a very interesting – they assumed I love spaghetti because I'm an American, and so they made this interesting noodle dish with spaghetti noodles and French fries. Also had guinea pig on top, and it was just a really strange combination of noodles and then some of their southern Peruvian dishes.
Yeah, so it's really interesting how, you know, in places that have seen a lot of mixing or cross-pollination, I can think of one on my journey, Kyrgyzstan, for example, which is on the border of China, but of course has had a lot of Soviet Union, Russian influence over the years. I came across amazing fried wontons with sour cream. Mm. And I had never thought about, you know, frying wontons and then pairing them with sour cream. You know, there was another dish that combined two kinds of noodles, you know, a wheat noodle and a bean noodle together with a spicy sauce and chili and coriander, and it was delicious.
Mm. Here's Brett in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Hi, Brett. Did I get that right? Welcome.
Hi, Murfreesboro. Anyway, I used to make my own pasta, what I like to do is, you know, where you just put a pile of flour on the cutting board and flip up a couple eggs and make a little volcano, mix it all together, and then roll it out and cut whatever shapes you want.
You got
I
it.
Found that if I took basil, oregano, and garlic and mixed in with it, it gives really super Italian flavor. And
I'll have to try that.
It's such a surprise when people eat it. You get this kind of green speckled pasta.
Yeah.
And then on the other hand, to go to the other extreme, I can use rice flour, and I don't really have the rice, so I just use cayenne pepper because I can buy it at the store, you know. And it gives you this kind of pink noodles, and you take a bite and it's hot.
Mm. Oh, that sounds delicious.
So you can change the flavor of pasta pretty easily. Brett, thank you.
Yeah, what I find really interesting about noodles and pasta is that they have assimilated into so many different cultures. I mean, something as different as Chinese food and Italian food. And, you know, in that story, you know, I could relate to noodles myself being somewhat Western and Eastern. You know, I like the idea that noodles and pasta can take on so many different flavors and sauces.
Tell us a story of another woman that you met on your travels that was memorable.
Well, you know, in Turkey, which is a Muslim country, you know, the range of women there was really amazing. In the eastern part of the country, you have women who aren't even allowed to sit in the same floor of a restaurant as men. Basically.
Right. I think you said the women are on the second floor.
Yeah. I mean, we kept on being told to go to the second floor and third floor of restaurants whenever we got there. And we said, well, what is, you know, and I actually just sat down on the first floor, not understanding this whole tradition. So there's kind of this, you know, restaurant apartheid that goes on there. And that also extends into the homes where basically the women cook the meals and then, you know, they stay in the kitchen while the men eat them. I was often considered an honorary man in those circumstances because I was a guest. So I was able to eat with the men. But then, you know, in the western part of the country, you have you come across women who are very independent-minded, very outspoken. In my book, I write about a dinner party that I had to cook for, where, you know, a dozen Turkish women show up before to watch me do the cooking. I'm cooking Chinese food, which the Turkish believe is this fancy hot cuisine because they don't have Chinese takeout restaurants there. Anyway, so I was cooking with these women, and they had so much advice for me, even though they didn't know anything about Chinese food. They were telling me, shouldn't this have more salt? And, you know, shouldn't this be cooked now? And very pushy and aggressive. And, you know, I met women who were, you know, the heads of restaurants, who were entrepreneurs there. So it really runs the gamut there. Yeah.
What was your favorite pasta dish that you tried along your journey on the Silk Road?
Well, it's hard to really pinpoint my favorite, but I have to say the dumplings that I made for you today, those the Monty, the Manta, the, you know, various itinerations of those dishes that, you know, that evolve into tortellini once you get into Italy, really are special to me because of the women who cooked for me.
And I'm going to finish off my Monty, and I might finish off yours.
Sure,
of course. You better watch it. Jen Lin Liu is with us this hour. She's author of On the Noodle Road, and we're discussing the history of the noodle. Behind us is some traditional folk music from Uzbekistan, one of Jen Lin Liu's stops on Noodle Road. It's called Dilbar, and it's performed by Abida Mirzabaga. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the history of noodles this hour, from China to Italy. We're joined this hour by Jen Lin Liu, author of On the Road, From Beijing to Rome, with Love and Pasta. Here's some sound I want to play. This is Prince Spaghetti. It made a famous spaghetti ad, and I think it was called Prince Spaghetti Day. This is the remake of it from this year, celebrating 100 anniversaries of Prince Spaghetti Pasta.
Traditions are alive and well in the north end of Boston, like coming home for Prince Spaghetti Day. For over 100 years, Prince and families like Anthony's have been making great pasta and wonderful memories.
It's really interesting. You were just saying in, as we were listening to that, how spaghetti has changed.
Yeah. Spaghetti, you know, when the 1929 Macaroni Journal came out and they came out with that story about Marco Polo
yes.
bringing noodles from China to Italy, that was actually meant to spur the consumption of pasta in the United States, which at that point was still considered, you know, probably as exotic as Chinese food was in the 1970s, mostly eaten in Italian American families, but not really outside of that. So that marketing story worked quite well, as we know today. And it's, you know, pasta is considered as American as so many other things. And one of the difficult questions that I had to face on my journey in Italy, somebody asked me what my favorite American food was, and I kept on thinking of things like pizza and lasagna and, you know, it was difficult to answer because so much of our traditions have come from Italy.
Hmm. Here's Anthony in Boston. Anthony, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Hi. First of all, I love noodles, but I wanted to call and share about my experience. Hi. There's a place right by the university that was actually operated by Uyghurs from Western China. On their menu, they had about 900 different combinations of noodle
wow.
and topping, and you could get them dry or in soup or over rice, and it was absolutely delicious. Mm. I think about it to this day, and one of the things that I dislike about traveling the most is when you get a craving for one of those dishes that's on the other side of the world, you know, it's not like you can go down the street and pick it up.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, one of the other things that I learned along this journey was how lucky we are to be a multicultural society with so many choices, restaurant choices and, you know, choices at our supermarket. In a lot of these countries that I went to, I'm thinking mostly of Central Asia, actually, their diet is basically Central Asian food. And, you know, it's basically 10 to 12 dishes that they eat over and over again. You mentioned the Uyghurs, and they are an interesting part of my book. The Uyghurs are a Muslim ethnic Turkish minority in northwestern China. They look as Caucasian as my husband, who's from northern Massachusetts, and basically they were sort of go betweens between China and Central Asia, and basically helped spread noodles from Western China to Central Asia.
Mm. So along this route, you started in Beijing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Beijing to Italy. You stopped in Iran. You stopped in Uzbekistan. You stopped in Kurdistan, Turkmenistan. You were
Turkey.
In Istanbul. You were in Turkey, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when you finally got to Italy, what surprised you about the pasta that you found there?
Well, in the middle of the journey, the tradition of noodles fades a little bit. A dish called plav, rice pilaf, kind of takes over. And it's not that noodles haven't been a part of the tradition in these countries. It's just that rice pilaf is the dish that they use to greet revered guests. And so everywhere we went, we were actually, even though I wanted to have noodles all in all these places, I was treated to many, many rice pilaf dishes. And then noodles kind of come back in Turkey and then through Italy. But, you know, what's interesting about it is, you know, this is just one moment in time that I'm traveling through. And it turns out that in places like Iran, for example, noodles have been a very prominent part of the culture in, say, the 11th, 12th, 13th century. But then they started to fade. There's even a poem that I found where saffron rice battles noodles and the rice wins. And that was kind of an illustration of how rice ends up becoming, you know, a bigger part of the cuisine. So, one of the lessons I learned from this trip that was summed up in the end with a quote by Charles Perry, a food historian, is that just because we're eating something today doesn't mean that we have always been eating it in any culture. And you see that a lot in America, of course. Given how much our food has evolved.
Back to the phones and Matt, who's in Buffalo, New York. Hi, Matt. Welcome to On Point.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead.
So my family has a Italian gourmet pasta factory down in Westchester, New York. And just watching the evolution of pasta in the American sense has been pretty amazing.
How have you seen it evolve, Matt?
Well, I mean, for example, we do custom orders occasionally, and one of the ones we got was for a crawfish tortellini in a barbecue sauce, which is something that when my grandparents came over here from Italy, they never thought they'd see.
How in the world did that taste?
I was not personally a fan, but I'm sure the buyer must have liked it because he kept ordering.
Matt from Buffalo, thank you very much for the call. Here's Jen in Burlington, Vermont. Hi, Jen. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I'm to ask about something I tried in the Lunigiana region of northern Italy a few years ago, which is called testaroli. And it's described as a kind of ancient pasta there, but it's baked in a cast iron skillet over a fire, then boiled and served with pesto. And I was wondering
fascinating.
If there's any baked pasta dishes like that.
Oh, yeah. I saw, a number of baked pasta dishes. Some of them you wouldn't even necessarily think of as pasta. There was a kind of dumpling in Central Asia called samsa that's baked in tandoori ovens, basically wrapped in the same shape as these dumplings that we're eating today and stuck into the inside of a tandoori oven and baked. Baking is, something that, the baking of bread, it's been long established before noodles, and I find it really interesting that, noodles come from bread. I mean, it makes intuitive sense that noodles come from bread, but I didn't really think about that before I wrote this book.
Mm. Here's John in Portland, Maine. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Yes, hi. I was wondering if Jen Linlu could comment on the existence of noodle soup outside of China and Asia.
Noodle soups. For example, in Italy, tortellini are most commonly served in soup. They're not, slathered with tons of tomato sauce. It is like it is here in the States. But the most traditional way of eating tortellini is tortellini in brodo, where it's bits of pork in a tortellini and then and cooked in a chicken broth. And it's absolutely delicious.
You know, some of the recipes that you have in here look equally as mouthwatering as they taste here in front of me. Are these all from the people that you met along the road?
Yes, they're all dishes that I encountered along the way and learned how to cook. The recipes that you see there are basically straight interpretations adapted for the American kitchen, but basically straight interpretations of what I saw. I didn't, add my own sort of – I'll do that maybe someday later. But, this was – I wanted the readers to get an authentic sense of and taste of what I experienced myself.
Mm. Here's Betsy in Virginia. Betsy, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a very interesting opportunity. I teach at a college that has students from all over the world, and so we have these interesting discussions. Do we need more potatoes, more rice, or more noodles on the menu? And it's so interesting to find out that, it's really the great bread, as I'm listening to Jen talk, it's the bread of all the cultures, these noodles. And I have Korean friends, and they have this wonderful dish called mandu, which means dumpling. And if you've never tried mandu, they boil it in soups. They also kind of fry it on the top of a skillet or a pan, and it has wonderful fillings in it. But mandu also means dumpling. So
linguistically, that dish mandu is related to the dumplings we're eating today. Manta.
I thought so.
Manto is a steamed bread in China, and so that word, according to food historians, traveled with Genghis Khan and his armies all the way from Eastern Eastern Asia. You also have mandu in Japan, all the way to the West. So I'll take the Genghis Khan story over the Marco Polo story.
Betsy, thanks so much for the call. Good luck with those students. Joe is in Memphis, Tennessee. Hi, Joe. Welcome to On Point.
Hey, I come from a large Italian family, and I used to make fresh pasta, so you're right on. The fresh pasta is much better tasting than store-bought pasta. But then my wife acquired a gluten intolerance, and would you believe I had to sell my pasta maker? So if you could comment or give me some resources on where I can start making gluten-free pasta from scratch. I would be most appreciative. Yeah.
So many people want that.
Yeah,
Joe, thank you.
Yeah, gluten is an issue. I mean, at my own cooking school and restaurant in Beijing, we have to offer gluten-free options for our guests now. I haven't really, experimented in that area. I found that the gluten-free pastas that I've tasted myself have never been as good. They're just a little bit more brittle, a little bit more tougher in the texture. It's really the gluten that gives it that taste and the texture. So.
Joe. Yeah. Is that what you're meant to say?
The gluten is something that creates that super fine, stretchy, those noodles, hand pulled noodles in, northwestern China, the right. ones that you see, basically done by hand and are thin as angel hair, they couldn't be made without gluten. Hmm.
Sorry, Joe, and many others. here's Catherine in Savannah, Georgia. Hi, Catherine. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. Thanks so much. I lived in Rome in the 1990s in a section called Trastevere, where the local
I love that area.
It's wonderful. And they call themselves I Veri Romani, the real Romans,
yes,
the old Romans.
Yes.
And when I would try to go to a store or go to a restaurant and order gnocchi, they would always say, solo al giovedì, only on Thursday. And I wondered if there are other noodles around the world that are meant to be eaten on a particular day of the week, or a particular season or month, and then they're not seen for the rest
of
the year.
Yeah, with the gnocchi, I believe it's because it was based out of poverty that basically you started putting potatoes in your pasta towards the end of the week because you ran out of the other stuff. So that's why they had it on Thursdays. For traditions in terms of noodles on specific days, in China, of course, long strands of noodles are eaten on your birthday so that you can have a long life, because they're long strands of noodles. You're supposed to slurp them and not, bite them so that, you don't, cut off your life, basically. Hmm.
Catherine, thank you for the call. Let's get a couple more in here. Dave in Portsmouth, Virginia. Hi, Dave. Glad you called. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm just touching on something that's part of the American culture in the prison systems, that they're using a lot of instant noodles, and they call the dish swole. And they'll mix it with just about anything that comes off their food tray and put it in a plastic bag and put it in the corner of their cell and let it sit there and kind of ferment. And I just wanted to offer that, let them know that happens.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, instant noodles are served in a lot of poor countries, the developing places that I went to, because they are the cheapest option. They are just everywhere, on trains in China, and throughout Central Asia, you find them too.
Thanks, Dave, for your call. Jen, as I was reading your book, I was thinking that you were originally interested in your sort of East-West heritage when you started on this trip. But it seems by the end, you became more interested in your identity as a woman and how you connected with these women along the path, women who cooked meals and prepared and took care of so many people along
the way. Right, right. I was born in the 1970s, so, the women's revolution happened a little bit earlier than I was quite young. And so, I tried to read The Second Sex and Gloria Steinem and all those things in high school and college, but I couldn't really relate to them. And, it really only struck me as, I was approaching marriage and, this time in my life when you're considering motherhood, that gender does have an impact on your life. And so that really figures into my book, the idea that I had this window of opportunity. I'd just gotten married, but we hadn't had children yet. We hadn't settled into, stable lives in the suburbs like a lot of my peers and friends. And so this was a chance for me to do a journey, a personal journey that I wouldn't be able to do nowadays, now that I have, a 20-month-old at home and I have another one along the way. It's still, we have to make choices as women. And for many of the women that I met along the way, that was true, and it helped me get a vantage point to see the struggles that a lot of these women faced on the journey, and you know, the balance between tradition and family and their obligations and wanting things for themselves.
Well, thank you for this remarkable journey along the Silk Road, and thanks for the manti. It was just delicious.
Thank you.
Reminded me, some of the best dumpling I ever had was in Istanbul about 10 years ago, and that rivals it. That was fantastic.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Zhenlu Li is author of On the Noodle Road, From Beijing to Rome with Love and Pasta. You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Behind us, the pasta song from Sesame Street. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And you cook it and you taste it. You pour it on, what do you got? Healthy things to eat, like spaghetti or agetti, pontaletti and linguine. You will wish your arms were longer when you lift it to your face. That capelli or anelli, vermicelli, parmigiana. And if you try to slurp it, you'll get sauce all over the place. Rigatoni, macaroni, cannelloni, and saline. You don't have to be Italian to enjoy a pasta treat. Pappardelle, aratelli, tagliatelle, fettuccine. You can start to learn the language just by saying things to eat.